Welcome to How to Write Kai Papers, the podcast. I am Dr. Leonard Nacke, an associate professor at the Stratford School of Interaction Design and Business and the director of the HCI Games Group at the University of Waterloo in Canada. It is difficult to turn an exciting HCI research project into a successful Kai publication. This podcast is here to help you. This is episode 3, interview with Joe Fish K.
So, hi Joe Fish, I'm really glad that you can join us for this Kai course on how to write a Kai paper. I know that you have some experience in the Kai community, but why don't you give us a little bit of a breakdown of who you are and what you've done for Kai so far?
Sure. So I've been coming since Kai 2003 in Fort Lauderdale, and I've published, I don't know, a good handful of papers at Kai over time and other publications. Last year, I've done various roles. I've chaired different things. And last year, I chaired the conference along with Alison Druin. And that was super fun, if a lot of work. And I spent a bunch of time looking at how we did things, how we organized stuff, so that we could work on making the process better.
Awesome. So I'm assuming you have some ideas about the process of writing a Kai paper and getting a Kai paper accepted. So before I go into details, I would like to ask you what you think about writing style. Is there anything that you would like to tell aspiring graduate students or young researchers wanting to publish at Kai that you would say, this is a really good writing style thing that I'm using myself that you could use if you wanted to really get into Kai paper writing? What's your secret sauce?
Sure. So I think the first thing to recognize is that there are a lot of different kinds of Kai papers. We tried to recognize this year when working with Frank Bentley, he and I redid all of the keywords. And there are one of the things that I think is really important to recognize is that when you're reading Kai papers, it's useful to understand what sort of Kai paper is it, because that means that when you are trying to write a Kai paper that is the same kind of argument, it doesn't have to be the same kind of topic, it can be a completely different topic, but you can say, ah, this is a paper like that one. And the places where it goes wrong is where people get it wrong. They clash. So you'll have a paper that is, say, trying to test a new device, right? That's one, that's a legitimate kind of Kai paper. And that's a really good kind of Kai paper. That's fine. But if you then try and say, well, the best Kai paper I have ever read is, say, an argumentation paper, right? Implications considered harmful, say. You can't use implications considered harmful, which is an argumentative essay type paper, to write a we tried a new device paper. So one of the things I try and do when I'm working with students or people who are new to Kai is to introduce them to this idea of what you read papers for. Sometimes you read a paper because it's got a particularly good method. Sometimes you read a paper because it's got a particularly good overview of the field. And so their related work section is a bit that you're basically stealing is a strong term, being inspired by. Sometimes you're reading a paper because the form of the paper, the rhetorical argument, the ways that they construct their argument is actually the important thing. So I think that's the thing to start off doing, is to look at the work that you want to do and say, okay, how can I use this structure as a way to structure my paper?
Okay, perfect. So looking at other papers as a template for your own writing. And you said that there are certain types of Kai papers. Would you say that there's any one type that is particularly successful in your own experience? Is there, because you said there are system papers, there are evaluative papers. Would you say, just looking from the other side of Kai, that there is a bias in the committees, maybe that there are certain things that are more preferred than others?
So I have my own impressions, and I did a bunch of statistical work to try and answer this question. The committees are the same. It turns out that all the committees have basically the same acceptance rates. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think is difficult for Kai that makes us different from other communities is that we're much more intellectually eclectic, right? If you're a databases guy, pretty much you're making a better database or compiler guy. And there's lots of good work that's out there where you can come at work with a single epistemological approach. And epistemology is a way of knowing what knowledge, it's a way of making knowledge. And so particular kinds of, if you're in a particular subfield of biological sciences, you've probably read the same papers that everyone else has read in the field, and that you have this shared set of epistemological assumptions about what creates good knowledge. One of the things that makes Kai really powerful but different to a lot of these others, and particularly, I think, different to other fields in under the auspices of the ACM, the Association of Computing Machinery, is that we have multiple ways of knowing, right? We will have design papers which are not science. They are very good papers, but they are not science. And so these assumptions about what makes a good science paper just don't hold. And I think, to be honest, the science that we often end up doing is pretty, we don't talk a lot about these processes behind the science, right? Like, most of our field has not read Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, or the sort of stuff that is standard in a first year science and technology studies program. And yet, I think we should be. Those are the things I'd love to see as grad students go and read that stuff and take an SDS course, because I think it changes the way that you think about how you create knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. And it sets you up for this way in which we are, it's not monolithic, right? It's not this sort of single path that we are all, you know, on the same thing. Every so often, there are another attempts to have grand challenges in HCI. And I think those can be very valuable, but they need to be written in a way that recognizes that we create knowledge in a bunch of different kinds of ways.
So the diversity of CHI is its challenge, but you're also saying it's its strength. I really like that yep. The power comes from that diversity. Okay, so let's go a little bit back to writing style and style quirks and pet peeves that you have. And these apply generally, in my opinion, when we're looking at writing good papers in general. Is there anything that when you're teaching your students that you would say, this is a particular style quirk or pet peeve that you have that students just keep doing it wrong for scientific papers that people just shouldn't be doing when they're writing CHI papers?
The main thing I think is that you want to write a good paper that is readable and enjoyable to read. And I really mean that about enjoyable. Like, I think.
But how do you make it enjoyable? That's the question.
The answer is you spend a lot of time on it, which is horrible because you don't have time. But one of them you do is you a lot of papers that you and other things, right? Fiction, whatever, that you consider good. I have an unfair advantage in that I'm a native English speaker. And if you're a non-native English speaker, it is a lot more fucking difficult. I speak a couple of other languages and none of them do I speak well enough to write a CHI paper in. But trying to notice when you see writing that you like, trying to notice when you're reading a paper and you're like, this is really well written, right? And again, this goes back to this idea that you can read papers for different reasons. You can read them because of the structure. You can read them because of the knowledge they tell you. Or you can read them because they are like, oh, this is a really well written paper. This is a paper that makes me delighted. Alex Taylor, for example, has very well-written papers. He has a style that's a little bit whimsical for me. It's a bit more whimsical than I, but they're very well-written papers. And I think there's a lot of other people that you can point to where you're like, yes, that is a really thoughtful, well-written paper. And for me, a lot of it, the things that when I read other people's papers and or my own papers even, I go back to, one of the weird things about CHI papers that are different to other forms of text is you have to signpost. You have to tell people what you're going to tell them. Then you have to tell them it, and then you have to tell them what you just told them. And at each transition, you want to say, hey, I just told you this, and now I'm going to tell you the next thing. And it's weird, but when it's not there, you notice it, because you'll read a paragraph or two, and you'll be locked into the story of that paragraph. And then, despite the fact that they may be describing four different things people do, if you're reading the second thing, and then it jumps all of a sudden to the third, you're like, oh, wait, what are we still talking about the same thing? It's easy to lose track of the structure. So those sort of signposting things are things that I find I tell people to put in again and again. And I really think it makes it better to read. The other thing that I would say is that sometimes the story of a paper is not what you think it is when you are writing it. So you say, hey, we've got this. I'm trying to think of an example I can use because I was just reviewing a paper yesterday, but I can't talk about that one because it's not mine. And I have another paper where one of the ones I've got under submission for CHI this year, we realized it was actually a different paper than we thought it was and reframed it. The short version was we had thought we had a paper that was a ramping up, and it was like, okay, and then this and this, and then this conclusion at the end. And the problem was the conclusion at this end, God, I hope you're not reviewing this paper. The conclusion at the end was not as strong as it could be. And then somebody, one of my colleagues, read it and said, you don't actually have this linear thing. Think of it, you've actually got four contributions, which you thought of as steps along this thing, and there are actually four distinct contributions. One, two, three, four. Your fourth one is a little bit weak, but your one, two, and three are really strong. And so that realization that the first thing you do when you sit down to write a paper should be to write the abstract. Weirdly, the last thing you do when you write a paper should be to write the abstract. Because you go back and you say, okay, now we've finished this whole thing. What's the thing we're saying again? Are we sure that our abstract actually tells the story? And then does the introduction tell the story? And I would do the same with the title. I suppose I would revise that statement. The first thing you do when you sit down to write a paper is to write the title. And the last thing you do is to write the title as well. And the titles, I like to say that titles should tell you what you need to, why you should read the paper, right? They should tell you what the paper tells you. I always like to say that if Kai people wrote like mystery novels, it would be called something like The Butler Did It, : The Case of the Missing Plot. Tell them why they should read this paper. Because most people are going to read, at best, a lot of people are just going to read the title. Then they'll read, some smaller number of people read the title in the abstract, and a smaller number of people read the title in the introduction, and then maybe some people will read the rest of it. But really, you've got to make the odds in your favor. And if you have one of these sort of enigmatic titles, like rhetorical questions that are not, should be answered in the title, people, whatever, put computers in their noses, right? It should be, people put computers in their noses, : I did do a statistical analysis, and which is on the SigChi Tumblr site somewhere, I think, about whether you should put colons and question marks and things like that in your titles, and you can go and read it. It is meaningless, but it is, I do not believe that there is inherent value in this, but people do seem to do it, and there is a correlation, but correlation is not causation.
Mm-hmm. So this is actually quite interesting, because now you talked a lot about the contribution, you talked about the abstract, and I was actually going to ask you that we have this skeleton that we use for general scientific papers, and we've said the abstract is the most important thing. You said to yourself, you write it at the start, you write it again at the end. If you were to break down the abstract, which is the golden nugget of every paper, what would you break it down into? And now I have a very strong opinion about this, and I know other people that I've interviewed have a very strong opinion about each and every sentence in the abstract. So what is your opinion on the sentences that should go into the abstract?
That's fascinating. I've never actually thought about that on sentence. I've never prescriptively come up with it. Nature has a really nice annotated abstract for how they like their abstracts, which aren't quite like ours, but it's informative. And again, I think the important thing is it's a narrative. It tells you a story, right? Approximately speaking, your first one is, why should people give a shit about this? Like, why should anybody care about what the fuck you've just published? So that's your first sentence. Then you go and you describe, this is what we did. I don't believe in putting related work into the abstract. Like, it's, try and avoid it. It's sloppy. You should be able to say why it matters without resorting to the higher authority. And then you say, and that's for Kai. There are different places in which that is, Nature being one of them. And then I generally try and do one sentence for each major thing. Often that turns out to be like a thing for the method. We did an experiment. I try and put stuff in there. Again, this goes back to this epistemological assumption. What you want to do is show in your abstract that you are creating valid knowledge according to the metrics that you consider to be important. So if, for example, so we care a lot about N in Kai, right? The number of people that you do something with. That's a thing to signpost in there, right? To be like, we got 147 people to answer a survey, or 10 people to use our prototype, or whatever it is. But I believe in putting those numbers in there if they are strong. And to be honest about this, if they're weak, if you're like, yeah, we got like 15 people to look at it, then maybe you don't mention them. But if the things are strong, you put them in there and you tell the story and you include these sort of shibboleths of quality, right? These markers of quality that you can point to where you're like, oh, we did this. Method is the one place I don't actually believe in putting in. You say what you did, you don't put the markers of quality of the method, right? You don't need to say one of those ritualistic statements people write about grounded theory, in which they're like, we did grounded theory, and then we used a system of multiples of coders who something. It's just say, like, we analyzed it, and people don't care about putting computers in their noses. However, and again, I'm a believer in putting takeaways in the paper, right? You want to put it in some place where, in the abstract, where people will say, oh, this is actually useful. So one paper I did recently, for example, we did an analysis of text messaging. And one of the things we found in this text messaging was that text messaging is actually different to normal written English text. And it's so different that the order of the frequency of letters is different. So in both text messaging and in normal English, the letter E is the one you use most frequently. But in normal English text, the letter T is the second most frequent, whereas in text messaging, it's an O. Huh. And it turns out the reason for that is that in text messaging, you use the word to, like, let's go to the park, and the word you, like, you go to the park. And so that was such a cool conclusion that we actually put that, there's a sentence in the abstract which says, hey, that's that thing.
Nice. Okay, so a bit of foreshadowing. But then at the end, did you say at the end you should always have the contribution and the takeaway at the end of the abstract? Is that an important thing for you?
I like to put that in. And again, that is one of those things where there are religious differences in this. Some people believe, some people like, I think of it as being the elementary school book report. And if you want to know what happens next, read the paper. And the answer is no, don't fucking do that. And I'll fight people who say that in public. Let's be realistic here. Most people don't read most papers because we can't, right? Like, there are 500 papers that were at Cairo this year. You can't read 500 papers. And particularly, you go into a new domain, that question of, okay, I need to know. Because I definitely, my career has been one of serial expertise. I'll spend a year working on this, 2 years working on that. And I think I've been pretty successful at doing that. But it requires a certain freedom in you. You need to be able to go in and absorb a field reasonably quickly. And goddamn, I'm going to be reading the abstracts and not the full papers. And then you figure out which ones are important. You're like, oh, I'm going to read these 5 good papers or these 10 good papers. But you read 50 abstracts to get to that stage.
True. Yeah, it does help a lot. If you're, and you've talked about this already a little bit, that our papers usually have those structural units. And you said we have the abstract, we have the introduction, related work, main methods, results, discussion, limitations, future work, all that stuff. Is there any section in particular that you would say Kai puts a specific emphasis on or that reviewers really emphasize when they criticize a paper?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we give undue work due. We put a little too much emphasis on related work because it is the unfortunate nature of the world that often people end up doing shit. And then afterwards you're like, oh, I didn't know that other people had done this. And then you write one of these bullshit related work pieces in which you say, we were also inspired by A, B, C, and D. And you're like, but we didn't read them before we did the work. So I do feel, I mean, one of the things that a lot of other fields do is they actually put the related work towards the end. I think it's, I've seen fields where they put it between, maybe after the discussion, somewhere around there, definitely after methods and results. And then you're like, oh, and this is the stuff that other people have done before. I don't feel strongly that we should do this one way or the other, but I do feel that as a field, we do fetishize related work. And like everyone else, I try and, if I'm starting a new project, you go and read the stuff that you can find, but you will invariably miss stuff. And I feel like the related work has become a bit of, it's not necessarily the way in which we really, I think, the related work has become a way to show that you have done all the right things for the field. I'm not sure I believe that it is necessarily the right thing for the quality of the research. I do writing the methods section really early. Ideally, you write the methods section when you are doing the methods. That being said, I would say my hit rate on that actually happening is like 1 in 5. But the idea that you say, no, we actually did this. Method sections, I also believe really strongly in actually saying what you did. I was working with a grad student the other day who, I don't know what crack he was smoking because he was going off in some very weird directions. I'm like, yeah, but you didn't do this. You told me we didn't do this. What are you doing? So it looks better that way. You're like, no. And there's a delicate balance there, right? Between how much you say, what do you leave out? There is no need. This made me very uncomfortable as a graduate student, but you don't necessarily need to tell the whole truth. You need to tell the truth, but not necessarily the whole truth. And in particular, what you don't need to do is tell the story of, you need to come up with you need to say the conclusion you have come to. You do not need to say how you got to that conclusion. Because if you're like, oh, we're trying to build nasal computers, and you're like, we started by trying to put computers in people's ears, and that didn't work, and I put them in their mouths, and I couldn't speak very well. And then we put them in their noses, and then it was great. You don't need to tell the story of the project. You need to tell the takeaway, which is, oh, nasal computers don't work. I don't know if I'm stuck on this nasal computer idea.
I don't know either. I have a feeling like your Kai paper is all about the nasal computing or something like that.
One of these days I'll write the nasal computing paper and be like, ah, I've been talking about this for years.
It's going to happen. Okay, so yeah, so now having talked about all the structure and some of that stuff, and I think you've already named some examples of papers that have done that excellently in terms of how they structure their papers. Do you, off the top of your head, you might not be able to, but do you have any papers or any authors that you can point to that have really great structural approach to Kai?
Yeah, I think it's so domain specific. There are specific things like if you're going into doing keyboards and text input, then you need to go and read what Scott McKenzie does and look at how he structures his papers. You can look at collections of papers, right? So the Braille Touch stuff that came out of Georgia Tech, that was interesting because there's four or five papers, all of which are called approximately, we did a thing called Braille Touch. And one of them is the key one, right? It's, I think it's the mobile HCI paper, in which they actually did the evaluation. And the other ones are sort of ways around that. But really that one is the core one that contains that. And so it's instructive to look at that as a, let's look at how they pulled those together, right? And the sort of distinctions there. The best, it's interesting that when you ask that question, the thing that came to mind is actually a book. It's called The Commonplace of Law by Susan Silby and someone else whose name I'm totally blanking on. What I love about it is you could recreate the outline of the book by reading the book. You could actually write down, it's a study of an ethnographic study or an interview-based study of how people in New Jersey think about the notion of law and laws. And it's superb. It's really good. But one of the best things about it is that it's so well structured and it's so well signposted that you could go and recreate the outline just by reading the book.
Nice.
I'm trying to think of other examples of papers that are really well structured. Yeah, nothing. There is nothing particularly that comes to mind across all my papers, of course, which are super examples of text.
Talking about your papers, though, is there one of your papers that you would say you're really proud of? And this is one where you would say, this is one where I did a really great job of structuring things?
And of course, I'm thinking of my most recent papers, which is not as in the ones that are currently being rejected for Kai. I would say that there's one I wrote called To Have and To Hold with Janet Vitesse and some other folks. And that one is a really nice way to do, it was actually a qualitative methods class. I'm not sure, I don't think this is actually in the paper because you hide the origin sometimes. It was a qualitative methods class with Trevor Pinch at Cornell. And he had some idea about some project he wanted to do. And I was like, look, I'd really like to know, how am I supposed to keep my papers? Like, how am I supposed to organize my books and papers? Because I just don't know what the right thing to do is. Can we interview people about that? And so we had eight people in the class. We went and all interviewed five or six people. And we wrote and then basically Janet and I took the remains of the class and then wrote the remains of that project, that group-wide, class-wide project, and wrote this paper on it. And I think we did a pretty good job there of doing the structuring.
That's good. I'll probably look that one up and see if I can give that as an example to the students. So veering off from that a little bit, do you think in general that there is a type of research that Kai is very conducive to? Now, you've said there are different venues and different things that people like at Kai, but is there just like, if you look at keyboards versus nasal computers versus like, what topics would you consider to be pretty hot, at least right now, in terms of Kai research?
Yeah, I'm glad that one of the things I think we're seeing is we're seeing more and more Kai is becoming a broader and broader church under which, and one of the things that I think I've seen as a pattern is things come in and people think they're funny and make fun of them. And then as time goes on a bit, they actually become legitimate fields of research. Smell-based computing was like, when I first submitted that paper to Kai, I got a review back that asked if it was a parody. Was this like, is this a parody? It's not even a very funny parody. Here's a better paper that's a parody of smell. And now that's sort of, I was in fact delighted when I started to see papers about smell computing that weren't citing me, because it's now become, it's like cultural probes, right? You don't even cite the cultural probes paper anymore. You just say, oh, we did a cultural probe. And in some ways you've succeeded when you become a household name. Mm-hmm. And that's smell computing is like that. But like the animal computing stuff is something that's actually become a lot more thoughtful as a domain. Initially it was, oh, this is funny, and then people are like, oh, actually there are legitimate questions here that are turning out to be relevant and important. Sex is a periodic topic. We had a huge fight at Kai 2006. We did a workshop on sex and computers, and there was really some very unpleasant interactions. Like, me and some other grad students were accused of supporting child pornography and things like that, and it was really a very ugly scene. And now I think we're seeing that become people like, yeah, that's a totally legitimate topic of interest. On things close to home, like the finance stuff, money and finance has gone from, again, being a topic where when I wrote a paper called Money Talks and for 2014, and there were a few other people, John Vines was doing a bit of work on money, but not a lot of people were. And now we're really seeing that as an established thing that, of course, you talk about how people think about money at Kai. So I think there is an increasing bunch of stuff. There's some stuff you're seeing less of. You definitely have fads, you have phases. I don't really think it was fads. I think it was phases where stuff is particularly important and relevant, and then it becomes less important and relevant, and that's okay. Some stuff, it surprises me how evergreen it turns out to be. You look at things like the task, the question of how you put text into a computer turns out to be, that's Scott McKenzie being the obvious one, but this is a thing that a lot of fucking people have spent a lot of time doing a lot of stuff on. We've got some solutions that under certain circumstances work okay, and under others they don't. And so looking at those sort of like long-term things, but I don't necessarily, I would be uncomfortable saying that those are therefore more Kai than something that's been around for less long. I think the strength of Kai comes from the fact that it is responsive, and we're starting to see more and more things that are thoughtful, and you have to step back and think, how does this contribute? I will say that I think it is probably easier to not come up with a whole new thing for Kai, having done it many times myself. It would probably be easier not to do that. I wish I was better at that, but sometimes research needs to be done, and you're like, here's this thing, and unfortunately there isn't great work on this previously. The money stuff was really a hard sell, and were I pointing people to say, if someone was trying to come up with a new thing that they were trying to sell to Kai, I think one of the things we do in that paper is really sell the idea that money is part of Kai. One of the things that in general, this is a specific piece of particularly devious advice. It is very tempting to write a paper where the introduction goes, no one has ever studied nasal computing ever before as part of Kai, but now it should be part of Kai. Because then the natural reaction of your reviewer is to be, well, like, dude, if no one's ever studied it, why the fuck should we talk about it now? And a much better rhetorical way to frame that is, nasal computing has been part of Kai for years. Look at these things, these little points, and we can join this point and this point and this point, and they're a bit of a stretch, but if you look at sort of the path, see how it's always been there. And here we are bringing it to the forefront, and people are like, oh, yeah, that's okay. Yeah, that's good. And it's a much more effective strategy to introduce a new topic into a field is to find a way to – now I'm giving away – this is my best secret, you know. That's how I do all my stuff. But it turns out that's it makes reviewers happier. It makes you happier. And it I think particularly as a graduate student, it's easier to get into this, yeah, you guys don't understand. And that's a thing that graduate students should do, right? If you're a graduate student, you don't have that, then you're probably not being critical enough about the field. And yet you need to find a way to do that and yet still be able to write a good Kai paper. And I think this way of trying to find ways in which you can convince the reviewer and convince yourself that in fact this is a really legit topic of research. But the reason it's legit is because of this long history in the field. And sometimes it requires being a careful reading to bring that out.
Nice. So this is already going into the right territory, because my next questions would be exactly those day-to-day tips for the graduate students that are a little bit more personal. So for example, when you're writing papers, is there any specific technology that you use? Do you have favorite programs, favorite operating systems? Do you use little helper programs, thesaurus or a dictionary? Or what do you use when you're writing papers? Do you have any secret tools, or do you just use a regular setup? And what would that regular setup look like for you?
So it's interesting because as I get more senior, I feel like I have less control over those things. As in, I get brought in on papers with students who already have infrastructure. Nearly everything, so I use a Mac, everything happens in Google. Basically, generally, things initially happen in Google Docs. At some point, you take the leap and you dump the whole thing into Word, and then you cry a little bit, and then you're done. I don't actually use, the way I keep track of my papers is that I have a folder called Papers, and within that, I have about a bagazillion subfolders which have topics, right? And so a topic might be, some of them are very vague, like design, and some of them are very specific, dirt eating. There's a whole phenomenon where particularly pregnant women sometimes eat dirt. And so I have the three or four papers that have ever been written about that in that folder. I also, this is a little bit of a sort of fetish, I have another folder in which I keep the proceedings for conferences that I've been to. So I have all of the proceedings for Kai going back to about 2003, I think, actually, or for conferences where I, like if I missed a year of CSCW or something, then I would keep those proceedings also and keep them locally. Because the nice thing is that then when I have a topic, I'm like, oh, I wonder what I know about. Then I put it in, and then Spotlight, because everything is indexed through Spotlight anyway, then I can pull up a paper that's relevant. It's also actually weirdly useful for people stuff. I'll talk to someone for the first time, and maybe it's a job, maybe it's something like that, and I can with one click pull up the stuff that I know that they've done, right? Like I put your name in and I'm like, oh, biofeedback game design, Kai 2011, Sig Kai Games. Yeah, that was a Sig meeting. Cube Lendar. That's interesting. Let's look at that. Oh, that's a different Lennart. That's what's going on. Okay. But being able to have that like there and not have to go and search the digital library for it. I mean, I still use the digital library and stuff because it does have some utility, but often just being able to do keyword searches of having everything local. Plus, I'm old, right? I think the young people of today, everything's in the cloudy and whatever, but being able to have that thing accessible local. It's on Dropbox, right? But everything is. Oh, yeah, so it's worth mentioning. I do use Dropbox. I do use Google Drive. I find less reliable than Dropbox. But Google Docs is so fucking useful for simultaneous editing that like that it's worth it. I have used various systems. We used a really nice thing from a guy at the University of Calgary, saturation app for coding text. So you have text and then you go in and you tag particular words with codes. Doing that collaboratively, it does a really good job. No one seems to have heard of it. Like it's not got anywhere near the level of, like, it's less popular than a lot of the other options. It's approximately free, and I think you do one project for free, and if you want another one then it's like $5 or something, and it's actually really good, and I wish more people had heard of it. And then that's saturateapp.com, and that I would highly recommend. That's like a nice secret weapon. So the particularly for distributed teams trying to do qualitative analysis, and it doesn't do too much of the, I'm never very fond of the overly tight readings of things where you're like 8.7% of these utterances contained references to me or my, and you're like, to me that assumes a base case of how language works, which I don't necessarily consider to be valid, particularly in a world in which lots of people are speaking English as a second language or whatever language you're analyzing as a second language. And I dislike that feel. And so Saturate App doesn't do a great deal of that. It'll let you do it if you really want to, but it's not built with that.
Do you use a reference manager at all?
No, mainly there's a couple of reasons. One is that usually if I'm working with a grad student, they have their own system, and rather than fight it, I'll let them do it. I find that having the papers themselves on the drive gets me what I want. Then when I want to go and put it into the references, then I just cut and paste from the ACM Digital Library or from Google Scholar, and it's quick and it's done. So I don't actually find it. I don't think I'd lose that much. I do use them. When if you're doing a LaTeX paper, then you need to be able to do, then you need to have that because everything's in BibTeX. But I don't care that much about it. Like it's one of those things that you can put a lot of time and energy in, but none of them are particularly well suited for collaborative use. And the combination of collaboration and integration. I used Zotero religiously for a while. When I was doing my dissertation, I did it in Zotero. I almost broke Zotero because it just at that stage could not cope with the scale of the shit that I was doing. Remember like generating the biography for my thesis, and I literally walked away for 20 minutes praying that the computer wouldn't crash, and then came back at the end. I was like, that's it. I'm never touching this again. like someone says there's other work. I'm like, that's nice.
Perfect.
Yeah, shared Google Drives I really believe in. Keep all the stuff in one place. Meaningful file names, another way I show I'm old. But for fuck's sake, I was just dealing with some students who didn't do this, and they've got stuff in there, and it's called something like ref1.doc. And I'm like, no, never do that. Put stupidly long file names if you want, but make it so that what's there. Be really consistent about naming users, right? I'm actually a big believer in giving fake names that are algorithmically generated to match gender and generally ethnicity. But so let's say that I was interviewing you for something, then I might give you a name that begins with M that seems vaguely appropriate. So, I don't know, Mark, or maybe Mark with a C, I think might be more. Sometimes I ask people so it's L plus one letter. Sometimes I'll ask people to pick their own names. That's a sort of nice thing to do because it makes them feel like they're part of the doing it with you. It depends on the study whether that's particularly important or not. If you are doing a study where it's really important that you maintain privacy, then I'll usually do that. But yeah.
Cool. Other than writing tools, once the Kai deadline comes around, like most of us have our own little strategies in terms of how we build the perfect environment to write Kai papers in. So do you have a perfect environment that you like to write in? What kind of music or noise do you listen to when you're writing? Do you have any preference, or do you just make it happen? Is there a secret?
I just, I, I just make it happen. I believe in, I print papers, I print things out, and I'll scribble on them. Like I do more and more, again, I think as I get more senior, I'm doing more and more editing and less like writing raw, huge chunks of text. And sometimes I'll be a circular thing and be like, okay, take this, rewrite this whole paragraph because it sucks. But generally anything that's, I'll generally do a lot of printing stuff out, circling stuff, rewriting sentences on that, and then come and enter it in. Yeah, perfect environment. I think since I had kids, my ability to get half an hour alone, I'm like, this is great. Look at this. Nobody's climbing on me. I do a lot more. Like, it's the only time I don't really work on weekends. I don't really work on in the evening much anymore. But for Kai Deadline, I put the kids down and it's like, okay, now it's back to work. Warning my wife in advance of that has turned out to be a useful strategy that I would recommend people do. Be like, this is what, you know, the next week's going to be a bit of a bitch, just a reminder. I'd like to believe it's become less obsessive. I feel like I went through a stage when this was, it just totally takes over your life, partly again because I'm right doing less of the raw writing, more of the sort of thinking and structuring and whatever. So it's a bit less desperate than it used to be.
Do you have, when you're writing and when you're going through the paper, is there anything that you're very nitpicky about, like figures or tables or how the text is laid out? I know some people really deal with like white space issues an hour before the deadline that they get very obsessive about little things. Do you have any like that? Or
I will do that, but I try and leave it to the hour before the deadline deliberately. Mm-hmm. Like, the last thing you want to do is prematurely say, oh, I'm just going to move this one down a little bit so it's at the bottom or something, right? Like, the longer you can leave that, the happier you will be. So I'm a big believer in leaving that for as late as possible. When I redid the templates last year along with Ayman Sharma, we spent a bunch of time really trying to redesign some of the things to make them a little less heavy-handed. So much lighter grays instead of black lines for the tables, making it as clear as possible, making it visually look good. There's some things we didn't quite get right, partly because there's differences between, there's things you can do in LaTeX and things you can do in Word, and they don't fully intersect. Captions underneath tables in the LaTeX template, if they're short, they're centered, as they should be, and if they're longer, then they're justified, right? So you've got like a paragraph description, which you should have, by the way, because blind people can't see fucking graphs. It's really fucking simple. And no one has developed a good way for blind people to see graphs. So you have to say in your graph, in your figure, why they should give a shit about this graph, right? Say what it tells you. Whereas in the Word template, it's all centered. And even if you've got a whole paragraph, it's centered and it looks ugly as sin. So people should just justify it because otherwise it's ugly. Why would you do what the template tells you if it's ugly?
Okay, let's finish with one more question about if there's any Kai researcher or writer that you have a little bit of an academic crush on that you really admire for their writing, and maybe also for the way that, you know, not just what we asked earlier in terms of that it's a good example, but just that you think they're doing really relevant work, even if it might not be the greatest paper, but that you personally feel very excited about.
So there's lots, right? Like, that's one of the things I love about Kai is there's all these people who do great work. There's a whole bunch of people like Julie Kintz or Sariti Yadi, Sariti Schoenberger, who I think of as Sariti Yadi, who do really good stuff. Cliff Lampe does super work and is also does insane and frankly terrifying amounts of work of service for the community. No, I mean, I think we are, as a field, rife with remarkable people. There are people like Christina Hook, who every time I work with her or talk with her, I realize I'm not thinking as big as I could be thinking. I think Elizabeth Churchill has got this like history of just doing incredible stuff in the field. There's people whose approach I don't necessarily follow, but I have enormous respect for them, like Judy Olson. She comes from a particular epistemological scientific standpoint, and I respect what she does. And I think she is such a wonderful person. I don't necessarily, like she has a very sort of hypothesis-driven approach, which totally doesn't match ways that I'm comfortable with. But boy, it's great. People like James Landay, who are doing really great systems work. I still, one of these days, I'm going to get him to do an ethnography so we can actually appreciate that actually they might be hard work as well. No, it's a problem of stopping listing people, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Becky Grinter and the whole community that people have developed at Georgia Tech that really Beth has been a big part of is super. And I love the fact that we're seeing these emerging groups of people. Like when I went to Kai in 2003, Cornell was sort of didn't exist in the HCI world. And it was just that I was there and I kept meeting all these Cornell people who were there, like Jeff Hancock and Phoebe Sengers and Kirsten Boehner. And I was like, these people are so cool. And I keep seeing them again and again. And that's pretty much why I went and did my PhD there. And now Cornell is one of the heavy hitters, and that's great to see. UW has done amazing stuff. And even if I'm always confused about what bit of UW people, any one particular person is associated with. Yeah, no, I think I haven't. My problem is entirely making a short enough list, not a long enough list. The one thing I would say is we need to get better at recognizing this as a field in a way that makes us more powerful. So, for example, we need to get better at doing things like giving awards, right? The Chi Academy right now, I don't think anybody in the Chi Academy is under 45 and maybe 50. Let's say 45 so I don't offend anybody. We need to be, and there is a whole bunch of really superb people who are part of our field, and we need to be upping. You look at the number of people going in and it's been going up like this, but the number of people entering our field is going up like this. We need to be getting more serious about getting more people in the Chi Academy, more people in the awards. One of the things I was really pleased to see is the number of Chi-associated people that are part of the ACM now, right? Vicky is now running stuff, and she's one of ours, right? And Elizabeth doing stuff there as well, and a couple of other people. And we're seeing that. I mean, I think one of the things that's happened is that Chi has a very good gender diversity. I know our Chi conference was 50% women on the committee and probably a bit more. There's places we need to do better. The fact that there are subcommittees for Chi where there are no women on them, grow the fuck up. That's just not acceptable. But I think as a field, we're doing much better. And I think we are leading computer science in that. And I've published a paper in CACM, which we actually showed that. We have more women authors than basically anywhere else except for Grace Hopper, which is a different kind of conference. So I think we're doing really good stuff. And as a field, there's a lot to love about it.
Nice. Okay. And that's, I think, a really good closing to the interview. Thank you again very much for taking the time to talk to me about what makes a great Chi paper. And I hope we get to chat again at some future Chi conference.